So news from the ocean has been, well, bleak lately. Most commercial salmon quotas were sliced in half this year due to low fish counts. Meanwhile, alarming levels of domoic acid have kept crab off most menus, visiting hardship on coastal communities. And that's just this coast. Our guest today takes a global view of fisheries and their management. And yeah, the view remains pretty bleak. But he brings a hopeful message, too. He's part of a team of scientists that analyze thousands of fisheries from all over the world. They say that with a different approach to management, the majority of the world's wild fish could recover in a decade. Is this a bold plan or just wishful thinking? Dr. Christopher Costello joins us now to make the case for a plan. He's a professor of environmental and resource economics at the Bryn School of Environmental Science and Management at the UC Santa Barbara. Dr. Costello, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks, Emily. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this study is quite sweeping. You cite something like 4,700 fisheries analyzed. Before we delve into how and why a team of scientists goes around doing that, let's establish what do you mean by a fishery? What constitutes a single fishery?
So what we did is we looked all over the world at how fish are caught, and we decided to define a fishery as a certain species that was harvested by a given country in a given part of the world. And that led to, as you said, about 5,000 individual fisheries around the world.
So, you know, crab caught in the United States is different than crab caught in Canada in terms of a fishery, even if perhaps it's all part of the same ecological system.
That's right. And the reason we, distinguish those as two different fisheries is that usually when you cross an international border, they're managed by a different agency. And that is the case for most U.S. and Canadian stocks as well.
So when you parsed out 4,700 of these fisheries, that's a certain species in a certain country, usually harvested in a certain way. What were the points you were looking to analyze?
So we wanted to start by getting just a baseline of where these fisheries stand now. What is the current status of fisheries? And then we wanted to sort of take that as a starting point and ask, you know, how would different management approaches, including a business-as-usual trajectory, but also alternatives to management, how would those fare in the future? And we looked at three basic indicators. The first is livelihoods of fishermen. The second is the amount of food they produce, so the actual harvest that they could sustain in the long run. And then the third is just a conservation metric of how many fish would there actually be underwater.
And so these seem like very nebulous measures. I mean, taking a number and putting it on someone's livelihood maybe is easier than counting the fish in the sea. What kinds of existing science were you leaning on, and what did you have to work for yourself?
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question, Emily. It's sort of funny that counting fish is a very hard thing to do. They're almost impossible to see, and usually we're basing our estimates of current fish stocks on the catch, and if you can imagine all the complications involved with that. So we had to involve all kinds of different scientists, all kinds of different data, to try to get a good estimate of the current status. And we leaned heavily in that case, and you sort of suggested this, on what are called stock assessments. And so scientists will go around and use a number of different methods, different technical approaches, to trying to estimate the status of a stock. The problem is that of those 5,000 that we looked at, only about 400 or 500 of those have stock assessments. So believe it or not, you know, the other 4,500 fisheries in the world, we just don't know what the status of the stock is, or until this paper came out, we didn't really have a good sense of that. So we produced a number of methods that give us, you know, at least a first cut at where those fisheries stand. And so for the first time really in history, we have an estimate of where all those fisheries stand now and what their potential might be for recovery in the future.
And you mentioned earlier this stock assessment. Are these things that are based on the catch? Is that just generally how we do it with commercial fisheries? However many we catch, you multiply it by a number to say that's how many fish are in the sea?
Yeah, it's another great question. So there's a lot of innovation in the fisheries science world on this exact issue right now. So the simplest way to do it is, as you said, just look at the catch. But it's not a very accurate way to do it because, mm-hmm. for example, fishery managers, I mean, you alluded to this in your introduction with salmon. or with crab, you know, fishery managers are actively trying to, you know, monitor the stock and adjust the quotas in order to, you know, rebuild stocks or maintain them at high levels. So if a manager cuts a quota and all you're looking at are the data of how many fish were caught, it will look like the fishery collapsed, but in fact it's the manager taking, you know, aggressive action to try to restore a stock. So you can't just look at the catch. So one of the things people will look at is how much fishing effort was there and compare that to the catch. So that's one metric. And then another thing, and we do this a lot in the United States, is we actually go out and do independent surveys that are not related to the fishery. So we'll go out and have a research vessel that'll, you know, drag a net on the bottom and pull up fish and count the fish and look at the species and look at the ratios of those and try to estimate the stocks based on that. And then there are a number of other methods that can be used in, you know, what we call data poor situations, which, you know, frankly, is most of the world. I mean, the U.S. has a lot of data and a lot of resources to devote to this. But if you go to Vietnam or Bangladesh or China, they usually aren't engaging in this aggressive, you know, scientific effort to try to estimate stock status.
Uh-huh. And I do want to go there. We're talking now with Dr. Christopher Costello. He's a professor of environmental and resource economics at the Bren School of Environmental Science for the UC Santa Barbara and a scientist who worked on this very sweeping study, about 5,000 fisheries analyzed. Only 500 of them actually had stock assessments in place. I would love to have your thoughts on the state of fisheries at 800-838-3760, or you can email us jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Dr. Costello, we've been talking about methodology. I kind of want to move on to the findings of these 4,700, about 5,000 fisheries. Was there an average picture that emerged for the world's wild fish stocks?
Yeah, this has really, really become a very interesting question. On average, we have found that fish stocks are in poor health. So what this means is that if you think about what would a management target be, what stock of fish would you actually like to observe out in the ocean? And, you know, it depends on your view. It depends on your objective. If you're a pure conservationist, you'd love to see, you know, lots of fish swimming out in the sea and have no fishing take place. But that's not very good for fishermen's livelihoods, and it's not very good for, you know, for putting food on the plate. And if you sort of balance those objectives and ask, well, what's the best way to make money fishing? What's the best way to make, you know, to have food security from the sea? And the answer is you have to have pretty robust fish stocks. And so we found that, by and large, global fisheries are well below the targets that you would need in order to achieve that objective. So we're in, you know, so the news you alluded to earlier is pretty much right. There's a lot of room for improvement. By and large. But I do want to point out that we found a huge amount of heterogeneity. So we found a lot of stocks that were in horrible condition, and, you know, there's a huge amount of room for improvement. But we also found a large number of stocks that are actually managed quite well. And the U.S. stood out as a good example of that. Over the last decade or so, the U.S. has done a really tremendous job at recovering fish stocks. And so by and large, the fisheries in the U.S. are, you know, are in reasonable shape.
Well, in this study, which it's in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, researchers from UC Santa Barbara and the U of Washington and the Environmental Defense Fund are working on this. Dr. Costello, you lay out three approaches to future management. I want to talk first about business as usual. You're sort of singling out the U.S. here as a healthier example of business as usual, which it's a bit surprising to me because the headlines are so bleak and people are really feeling it in these coastal communities, you know, in terms of measuring the livelihoods of fishermen. One of the indicators you mentioned, I mean, the livelihood of a fisherman in Crescent City right now is not doing so hot. So how is the U.S. a shining example of business as usual, or is it?
Well, yeah, so I was saying in terms of the current status of fish stocks underwater. So if you look at the actual abundance of fish in the U.S. relative to the management targets that I talked about earlier, the U.S. is in much better shape than, let's say, almost all Southeast Asian countries. But that's not to say that there isn't a lot of room for improvement even in the U.S. And there are two dimensions of room for improvement. And this will, I think, get to your question about different approaches to restoring fisheries. One is that you know if the if you overfish a fishery, then you need to recover the fish stock in order to get those livelihoods back up. So that's a big issue, and in several U.S.-based fisheries, that's the case. We still need to recover stocks in order to get livelihoods back on the right path. And of course, one needs to keep in mind that there are random fluctuations. El Nino and things like that have year-to-year variation in stocks, so that needs to be taken into account there. But the other is that even if you have an abundant fish stock, and I think a lot of your fishermen in your area fish in the West Coast groundfish fishery, which is a federally managed fishery in the U.S. that's 50 or 60 different species of fish. And one of the big problems there is we've actually done a great job at restoring those stocks, but that doesn't mean that the economics of the fishery are on the right path. And so there are things you can do on the management side in order to improve fishermen's livelihoods, sort of independent of what the underlying fish stock is. And you kind of need both of those in order to have a thriving fishing community.
Well, and what would be some examples there of things you can do on the management side that would improve people's lives regardless of how many fish there are in the sea?
So that's a great question and something we looked at very broadly across the whole world. And, it's easy to have a U.S. view on this because we're so steeped in the way U.S. fisheries are managed.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, when you go around most of the world, there's almost no management at all. So if you go to most parts of Asia, and we identified Asia as a place that had a potential upside from fishery management reform because they literally just don't manage their fisheries. They might, for example, have a two-month closed season and then absolutely no oversight, no regulations, no nothing in terms of managing their fish stocks. And what that leads to is essentially a race to fish. It leads to a situation where fishermen are out there doing whatever they want, using destructive fishing gear, and depleting the stock from one year to the next. And you end up in a situation in many of those fisheries where nobody's making any money fishing. And, if there's a dollar to be made, a new fisherman just enters, and that's perfectly legal in most of those settings. So that's kind of a no-management setting that we call open access. Now, almost all U.S. fisheries do have fishery management, and there are lots of ways to do that. One of the approaches that we found looks good, if it's done right, is an approach that we call rights-based fishery management. And this is sort of a catch-all, but it basically the idea is to give fishermen a stake in their own future. So if you have just a regulatory setting where you're just constantly telling fishermen what gear they can use, when they can fish, where they can fish, that kind of sounds like, oh, that's good because we're, making sure that the fish stocks are healthy. But it doesn't do well for the fishery economy.
So, we are talking with Dr. Christopher Costello. I just want to invite, I'm Emily Curitan, and I want to invite all of our listeners to participate in this conversation. 800-838-3760 is the number, jx@jeffnet.org. I know a lot of people out there, you're talking about having a stake in fisheries. I personally know quite a few people who that's the case for. We'd love to hear from you now and what your experience is trying to define a management approach for this great shared resource, the ocean. Now, Dr. Costello, you just mentioned rights-based fisheries management and this idea of the difference between just regulating people and giving them a stake. Can you give us a real-world example of what that looks like?
Yeah, I think, Alaska provides a really good example of this. And, I want to say there's no silver bullet here. There's no one approach that's going to work everywhere and that's going to work perfectly for every possible objective. But when you look at the metrics that I mentioned earlier, the fishery economy, the biomass of fish or the conservation status of fish, and the fish catch or the food provision from the fishery, the approaches that stand out as being successful tend to have the same feature that fishermen have a long-run incentive to keep the fish stock high. Okay. Now, if you just regulate in the manner I suggested earlier,
mm-hmm.
fisherman's incentive is to go catch as much as they can within the rules, and even possibly to bend the rules if they can, if they're not going to get caught. Okay, it's just like kind of speeding on a freeway. If you can get away with 5 extra miles an hour, you're going to do it. And we sort of put fishermen in a bad position because we've, in a way, pigeonholed them into having to try to do that, try to bend the rules, try to put, you know, fish as hard as they can within those rules. Now, the approach that I'm talking about says, okay, what if instead of that, what if the fishermen that are, you know, current stakeholders in the fishery have guaranteed access to the catch in the future, not just today, but in the future, next year as well.
But would something accompany that for the years? I'm just thinking about some of these fisheries are very cyclical, where maybe there's just a glut of crab one year and not so much the next. And people who live that way know to save their money, or if something happens that requires a lump sum, they're in trouble, because it's not like you can say, I'm going to make $70,000-$80,000 a year being a crab fisherman. Would this kind of management strategy, would it extend kind of onto land for like social protections for fishermen, so that they're not compelled by economic worry to, you know, try to get the fish while they can?
So, this is a really insightful idea. And what I can tell you is, from looking at experience around the world, there are good ways to modify this approach, the approach I'm talking about, and other approaches to account for that kind of interannual variability. And one of the ways that's been most successful is, you know, if the regulatory agency can keep tabs on the stock, they can adjust the quotas each year in response to those environmental fluctuations. And if fishermen know they have a stake in the long run catch, then, you know, if I have a 5% share of the catch this year and 5% next year, well, if the stock goes up next year, my catch goes up next year because I still have 5% of it. So that allows you to adjust the catch from year to year. But how does that help the fisherman who, in a bad year, he's not going to get to catch much?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the nice one of the features here is that they then own an asset. So that thing that they have a guaranteed right to in the future, they can, you know, potentially go to the bank and say, okay, I can borrow against this asset, just like any other fluctuating thing in the economy. And, you know, farmers have a similar kind of a situation. So, you know, it's not a perfect solution because the world is random and is variable, but it is a much better solution than just the simple regulatory approach.
Let's take a call. We've got Nicole and Ashland on the line. Nicole, you're on the air. Welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I just sort of came in the middle of this conversation, so I'm not sure what you discussed. But I know that the situation is dire, and we cannot survive without a healthy ocean, at least not a dead ocean, is what is becoming of it. And I wanted to know if you I was wondering if you discussed all the dumping that goes on into the ocean, which is absolutely devastating for its health and well-being and survival. And without the ocean, life did begin in the ocean, supposedly. And I think if the ocean doesn't survive, then I don't think life on Earth will survive, period.
Mm. Nicole, thank you for your comments. Let's ask him about that pollution issue. Is that one of the factors that you analyzed in looking at these 5,000 fisheries across the world for their stock assessments and future, Dr. Costello?
Yeah, and Nicole, thanks for the question. That's a very interesting dimension of this. And in fact, that was one of the motivations for the study, is to try to figure out what role does overfishing play in the status of these fisheries versus things like pollution or climate change. And I mean, you could think of climate change as a type of pollution. And, you know, it's true, there's been a lot of new evidence and interesting new science on things like plastics in the ocean and, you know, sewage outfalls and things like that. But still we find that, you know, globally, the big issue facing fisheries, facing wild fisheries, is not pollution, it's overfishing. That's not to say we shouldn't fix pollution problems. Of course we should, and these are important problems. But for fisheries production, pollution isn't really the key or the dominant force. Now, let me make a comment on climate change, because we have another set of work that isn't published yet, but is forthcoming. And that work is all about the future of the oceans, thinking about climate change, which is a form of pollution. And there we find there really could be very significant effects, but that they're, again, highly heterogeneous. So, for example, in the poles, so the North and South Pole, we expect productivity to go up. So climate change could actually improve, you know, productivity of fisheries. But near the equator, which is the place that has the most poorly managed fisheries now, we expect productivity to actually go down. So those places could become quite a lot worse because of climate change.
A boggling amount of factors to consider here, Dr. Costello. With a couple minutes left, let's get one more call in. Brad and Ashlyn, you're on the air. Welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you, Emily. And thank you, Dr. Costello. I share the previous caller's concern. Even though the oceans are distant, we dump all our crap in them, including our pharmaceuticals, our industrial waste. And then we extract all the time, taking. And they're suffering, as he said, from climate change and other things, overfishing primarily. But is there a way to feed the ocean? I remember Buckminster Fuller said pollution is wasted resources. Is there a way to feed the whole darn food chain equitably so that, you know, there's an economic way to send the food source to the ocean and then expect a better harvest?
Thanks for that, Brad.
Very, very interesting idea, Brad. Maybe I'm not exactly answering your question, but we have been thinking about sort of a dimension of what you're saying, thinking about the food web, okay? So if you think of an anchovy that gets eaten by a larger fish, that gets eaten by a tuna, that gets eaten by a shark, that kind of thing, if we change the way we manage the anchovy, in a way we're feeding the higher trophic levels, the bigger fish in the sea. So if we want more sharks and we want more tuna, maybe what we ought to do is catch fewer anchovy. And it's in a sense, a way to feed the ocean. And so that's a dimension that we've been working on.
Been talking about better global ocean management with Dr. Christopher Costello. He is a professor at the Environmental Science and Management Bren School, UC Santa Barbara. Dr. Costello's study with many, many collaborators is in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.